Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. We come to chapter 2, The Wheel of Birth and Death. And the first section is called Cycles of Addiction, The Catastrophe. We keep making the same mistakes, finding ourselves following the same destructive habits. As David Bowie put it, we are, quote, always crashing in the same car, unquote. I think Ajahn Jayasaro has also made some mileage out of that. That song title. The teaching on dependent origination offers us a way out. For myself, this is a very impactful teaching. It's one of the main reasons I've been living in monasteries as a Buddhist monk for 40 years. What is important and transformative is not just the specific words of the teachings on dependent origination, but the principle which they embody, how to free the heart from destructive cycles. As the Buddhist scholar and poet Martin Verhoeven, former Bhikshu Hung Chao, put it, life is truly a dream. All of its troubles I alone create. When I stop creating, the trouble stops. Very simple. Life is truly a dream. All of its troubles I alone create. When I stop creating, the troubles stop. Doesn't mean that all our debts are magically paid or our illnesses are magically cured, but the mind stops creating that troubledness and is able to appreciate how things are. So Martin Verhoeven, he left the monastic life quite some time ago, and he's a history professor at a university in California, and he and Dharma Master Hung Shur were the ones who made a pilgrimage from Los Angeles all the way up to Northern California, to the City of 10,000 Buddhas. It took them 2.5 years, from the May of 1977 to October of 1979, bowing all the way up through Los Angeles and up the West Coast to City of 10,000 Buddhas, about 600 or 700 miles. Walking three steps and then bowing to the ground and then getting up, walking three steps and bowing to the ground the whole way. So it took them 2.5 years and had many adventures. There's a few books of their diaries and letters that they sent back to Master Xuanhua along the way. And they were so into bowing every three steps that when they got to the City of 10,000 Buddhas, they carried on bowing around the monastery for another 2 years. So these guys are serious, you know. They don't go for, oh, thank goodness that's all over, now I can stop. That's not in their vocabulary. So also, Master Xuanhua was the one who donated half of the land that comprises Abhayagiri Monastery. It was literally his dying gift to this community, Lumpo Sumedha was already going to be visiting California to go and teach over there, and Master Hua invited him to. He said he was going to come up and receive him at the airport when he arrived, which Lumpo was very touched by. But Master Hua was so ill by the time Lumpo actually arrived that he couldn't travel. So Lumpo went to see him at the monastery where he was down in Southern California, and literally from his deathbed, he donated 120 acres of forest that formed the original part of Abhayagiri Monastery, and he died shortly after. The gift of the land was on May 31st, and he passed away about a month or 6 weeks later. When we use language like, quote, liberation from the wheel of birth and death, unquote, the teaching can seem very dramatic and remote. Many readers have probably seen paintings from the various Buddhist traditions Tibetan, Thai, Sri Lankan, Burmese, Chinese, Japanese, that depict a circular wheel in the grip of a demonic-looking mythical creature. The outer rim of the circle is divided into 12 sections, representing the links of dependent origination. Many pages could be filled describing each of these traditional images in turn, but it'll be more practical and useful to look at these 12 in terms of their psychological qualities and how to work with them to conduce to liberation. So we included a picture. This is probably familiar to most people, seen in various different Buddhist monasteries or collections of Buddhist art. And oh, very good. Thank you for that sample copy that people can take a look at. So it seems like a very complicated image, there's a lot going on there. And so I'll explain it a little bit in the text coming up. It would be quite possible to do an entire book on the image of the wheel of becoming, the wheel of birth and death represents. But if you are interested in Buddhist cosmology, the two best books in English, there's not that much actually in English, but the two best books, I think the library here has copies of both. One is called The Three Worlds According to King Ruang, which is a classic Thai. It's probably the first book written in the Thai language, and it was translated by a couple of academics from University of California, Berkeley, the Reynolds. They translated that into English, and so that's a. Originally, it was composed by a number of elders in the nascent state of Thailand about 700 or 800 years ago. It was requested by King Ramkhamhaeng, one of the first Thai monarchs, and so that gives descriptions of the six realms and lifespans of different beings in those realms and what goes on and what they're like. So that's a classical book. And then more recently, Ajahn Poonadamo, who lives at Arrow River Forest Hermitage in Ontario, he has spent a long time putting together a large, a very similar compendium called the Buddhist Cosmos. It's not published widely, but I think we have we did our own print off from a PDF, and it's certainly we've got digital files of it. So that is a very comprehensive and thorough, even more comprehensive than The Three Worlds According to King Ruang. Ajahn Poonadamo put a lot of effort into that. So if you are interested in Buddhist cosmology and want to find out more of that, I've got a printout in my kuti, and I think there's one in the library as well. So it's called the Buddhist Cosmos, if you want to follow that up. Inside that rim of the 12 images are 5, or sometimes 6, sections describing the different realms of existence. Inside this is another ring, colored half light and half dark, representing the effects of wholesome and unwholesome actions. Lastly, at the very center are 3 animals, a cockerel, representing greed, a snake, representing hatred, and a pig, representing delusion. Each of these with its jaws clamped onto the tail of the one in front of it. These are the 3 akusala mula, the 3 unwholesome roots that form the very hub of the wheel of becoming, the cycle of addiction. As long as greed, hatred, and delusion are in place, then the wheel will keep spinning. So also, when we chanted the fire sermon, the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, along with the 6 senses, then the Buddha's describing each of those 6 senses and the sense contact, the feelings, the sense consciousness, the sense, the feeling arising from that sense contact, raga gina, dosa gina, moha gina, burning with the fire of raga, of passion, of dosa, of aversion, and moha, delusion. So in that sutta, he talks about them as fires, different kinds of fires. And in the imagery of this of the wheel of becoming, the Bhava Chakra, then they're represented as these 3 animals with and the tail of each one is in the mouth of the one behind it, so they're like a little circle of dukkha at the hub of the wheel. So before I go on, any questions, thoughts? Okay. These images can be very colourful, very interesting, very frightening, very mysterious, and perhaps annoying. What on earth is this all about? So many figures, so many things going on. What does it all mean? But the symbolic value of this representation of the wheel of birth and death is very great. It's highly beneficial in helping us to understand our own life. According to some scriptures, the Buddha declared that this picture should be installed over the gate of every monastery in order to represent the central teaching. It's a symbol that everybody who walks into a Buddhist monastery could relate to and be informed by. So that you don't find that mentioned in the Pali Canon, but it's in the commentarial literature. It's also said that in those commentaries that Venerable Mahamoggallana, who was the Buddha's second disciple, had great psychic powers and could easily visit all the different realms. And he was the artist of the original one, so they say, that he painted the image of the different realms and was the one who crafted the original Bhavachaka, and it was sort of sat over the gate of I think in the oldest stories, over the gate of the Jetavana at near Sarvati, and that then that was copied and installed in other monasteries around and about. That I don't know whether that's actually true or whether Mahamoggallana was indeed a gifted artist, but he certainly, according to the stories, was very accomplished at visiting different realms, and then would come back, and there's accounts of him telling in the suttas of him telling stories of what he encountered in the heavenly realms, or the hell realms, or the ghost realm, and so on and so forth. The animal and the human realms are very easily accessible to us, though they're not mysterious. But it was said Mahamoggallana could easily visit the other realms, and he'd come back and tell stories, give accounts of what he discovered there to help encourage and inform other Sangha members. The circular shape represents the wheel-like nature of the process, but equally significantly, it represents a mirror. When you look at that picture, you're looking at what you are and what factors comprise your life. The being holding the mirror is Mahakala, whose name means great time. Not like having a great time, but maybe having a great time up in the Deva realms. Maybe not having such a great time down in the hell realms or the animal realm or the hungry ghosts. But great as in Maha, as in the powerful and large. And Kala means time. Thus it is time holding the mirror that reflects what we are, quote-unquote, or what we seem to be. The main part of the image is divided into five or six sections representing what are called bhumi, or the realms of existence. Heaven, hell, the realm of the hungry ghosts, the human realm, the realm of animals, and, if a sixth one is included, this will be the asura realm, that of the jealous gods or titans. Sometimes the asuras are included within the Deva realm and are not given their own segment of the diagram, which they're probably annoyed about as well. If you have no faith or interest in the idea of such realms as distinct dimensions of existence, parallel worlds, these can also be seen as descriptions of psychological states. You don't have to believe in hell to understand what it's like to be angry. You don't have to believe in heaven to be enraptured by the sound of your favorite music. In this respect, heaven and hell are not things that are far away. So then I go into a little description of each of the, very short description of each of the realms. And again, this is very much a pocket version. I didn't want to spend half the book going over the symbolism of the six realms. So this is very deliberately kept extremely short. If you want to follow up more of it, then you can look in the Buddhist Cosmos or the three worlds according to King Ruang. So firstly, the human realm. The human realm is defined as the realm of those who live according to the precepts. So you can have a human body, but not be living in the human realm. In Buddhist psychology, a human, quote unquote, is defined as a being who lives by at least the five precepts. So that can be intimidating to people, but that's the definition, the manusa loka, the human realm. You're not truly human unless there's a substantial quality of virtue in one's life. That's what makes one truly a human being. That's what defines the manusa loka. So again, sometimes in the West, people can have a very sort of negative view, self-critical views of themselves, and so to hear that can be even more depressing than you can deal with. So it's not always a teaching that is sensible or helpful to share, but I feel it's part of the Buddhist mythology, and that it's also, in a way, it's a helpful principle that what makes us human is that the qualities of hiri and otapa, that moral sensitivity, and that if that is that sense of what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, and if that is muffled or lost or you know, overridden by our habits of fear or aversion or greed or busyness, dishonesty and so on, then that's the kind of situation where you have a human body, but you're not really living in the human realm. You're living in the realms of the animal realm, or in the at least amongst the asuras or the realms of insensitivity and with a lack of respect and attunement to the needs and the beings around you, and the effect that your life and your actions, your words have upon the beings that you live with. So that's the manusa loka, the human realm. Any questions? Again, these readings are for all of you. They're not just for me to be sitting here. Yes?
So you're saying you could be in the human realm, but if you don't follow the five precepts, you'll technically be a human.
You're a pugala, but not a manusa.
Sure. Is there an equivalent for like devas? So you could be in the human realm, but according to cosmology, like a deva, because your morality is so bad.
Well, it's sometimes people in the royal family are called devas, royals, high up, certain members of certain royal families, so it's representing that kind of very in a way, powerful or high-ranking or good-looking or wealthy, those kind of positions in society. Someone who's rich and famous and their life is filled with beautiful objects, often just in ordinary conversation in Buddhist countries or even in the West, you know, people say, oh, that person's living in a deva realm, or they have a deva-like life. But I think In Thai language, maybe Suvira is the word. I mean, talking about the king and queen, do they use the words deva to refer to them? They kind of have those crowns like the chadar. It's like a deva headdress that they wear in part of their royal regalia. Meru, huh?
I'm not sure. I know that. We believe that if they are born in the royal family, they have more chance to give to others or helping people, mm-hmm, than ordinary people. Uh-huh. So that's why we respect them. It's a Pumibun.
Also, that as we were saying at the reading yesterday, that devas can also understand the teaching, so that we, in the chanting, we do Sakka Deva Manusanang, the teacher of gods and humans, and so that devas, if they are inclined towards wholesomeness and wisdom, then along with their life being sort of very comfortable and beautiful and covered in jewelry, then they also can delight in spiritual teachings. And so there's often in the suttas you find very often devas coming to listen to teachings or asking for advice, and there's the first two sections of the connected discourses, the Sanyutta Nikaya, are the Buddha giving teachings to devas. Deva Sanyutta and Devaputta Sanyutta is the first two sections. There can be people who live deva-like lives, who are very rich and influential, or have a glamorous life and a lot of luxury, but they can be spending a lot of their time looking out for other people. Like Saveer was saying, they've got Pumi Bun, they're people who have a lot of merit or a lot of blessings, and they very actively use those blessings to help other people. Like the donor who's been supporting the construction of the buildings in the nuns area, or donated a very large amount of money to help build a new sala and so on. And, I would say he comes into that category. He's got a deva-like life. He's very born into a huge amount of wealth, but he's very concerned that the power that he has, the wealth that he has, is put to good use. And so that influence is, say, it's there, but it's steered in a wholesome direction. Yes?
Well, maybe a state of consciousness like jhana. Sometimes people are entering jhanas and they are in deva-like mind.
Yes, yeah, that's it. That's in the. I mention that in the next little section.
You'll mention.
I will mention that in the next little section.
Okay.
So the deva realm represents and embodies refined sensory pleasure, like delight in beautiful music, fragrances, refined tastes, or visual images. It also represents sublime states of bliss arising from concentration and meditative absorption. Particularly the jhanas are associated with the Brahma realms, so that the rupa jhana, the jhanas based on form, are related to the Brahma realms, the rupa loka, the lower chunk of the Brahma realms, and then the jhanas, the absorptions based upon formlessness, the arupa jhana, they're connected with the arupa, the formless Brahma realms. Because in the highest Brahma realms, the beings don't have they have no physical form at all. They're just as they're called, mind made. They're made of mind alone. They have no physical form. They are just they are sort of mind based beings only. Arupa, the arupa loka. So it's the upper Brahma realms, the Arupa Loka. Again, if you want more details on that, please go to the three worlds according to King Rua or the Buddhist cosmos. So that also the Venerable Ananda Maitreya, who I was mentioning the other day, he quoted, I'm not sure where it comes in the scriptures, but when he was here living at Amravati in 1980, he spent the rains here in 1986, and he was the subject of devas came up in one of his teachings or in his sessions with him, and he quoted this passage, Sabhe Deva Mahamulanti, which translates as something he translated it as these devatas, they are all utterly foolish fellows. Mula is foolish, utterly foolish fellows. So that devas can easily, like rich people or people who are from a privileged background, they can easily just be lost in their own entitlement and assume, you know, like Marie Antoinette, you know, let them eat cake, and the poor people were starving at the gates of the palace. And she said, "What's all the noise about?" And famous, well, whether it happened or not, the story certainly happened. So that the poor people of Paris. Gathered around the gates of the palace, and there was a great turbulence and distress on the street. And then Marie Antoinette, the queen, said, "Well, what's all the noise about? Why are the people so upset?" And said, "Your Majesty, they want bread. Oh, let them eat cake," was her supposedly her response. So in English usage, that "let them eat cake" is a way of describing incredible insensitivity and entitlement. Assuming that, well, why do they, you know, just because they haven't got bread, surely they can just eat cake instead. That's what that means. Let them eat cake. There's a kind of an equivalent story in the Buddhist scriptures. One very, very privileged layman, I think it was... I don't remember the name. It was it wasn't Venerable Yasa. It was another layman, and So he had grown up with a very comfortable and privileged lifestyle, and he was so indulgent that and his parents always gave him everything he asked for. And one day he and his friends were gambling and eating lots of snacks and just kept sending to the servants, go and get more cake, go and get more snacks, go and get more drinks. And so the story goes that the mother was looking after the kitchens, and the lads were gambling. I guess they were teenagers by this time. They had sort of used up, a lot of the food in the larder had been consumed by these teenage boys gambling and seeking their pleasure. And so she told the servant to go back to her son and tell him, there aren't any cake. There isn't any cake. Nati Purvam is the part. There isn't any cake. And he'd never heard that word, there isn't any cake. So, oh, Nati Purvam, I've never heard of that before. That's a different kind. So, yeah, bring some Nati Purvam. And so it's a kind of let them eat cake story from the Pali Canon. No, Nati Purvam means there isn't any more cake. You've eaten it all. Like, what? No. Just bring some of that Nati Purvam. You can't understand that it's run out because there's never been everything that he wanted throughout his entire life. The mother was trying to give him a lesson on limited resources. So that's a deva-like life. There's a limitless supply of things that you like, so you can be lost in that entitlement or just presuming that the luxurious and delightful things are always available and you're entitled to them. Or as I think in one of the Mae West movies from way back in the 20s and 30s, she has a line, "Peel me a grape, Beulah." I'm talking to one of her servants. She's acting a very sort of rich and deva-like lady in that particular film, and turns to her servant and says, "Peel me a grape, Beulah." So that also gets people looking a little bit blank. So Beulah was the name of the servant. And to be so refined that you like to have your grapes peeled is a very over-refined standard, I would say. But that also gets used in English. Peel me a grape, Beulah, is a kind of ridiculous degree of expectation and refinement. Are there any questions on deva realms? The Asura realm is the domain of the jealous gods, quote-unquote, the titans, beings who are powerful, intelligent, and love pleasure in the same way as the devas, but because of jealousy, they are generally not as beautiful, nor do they have as much power as the devas. The realm of the jealous gods is like the political sphere, where there is hunger for power, and the forces of the world are always in competition. This is the realm of the Asura. So, you know, deva is also that kind of brightness or that potency in the world. The realm of politics, there's a lot of competition. And people might be bright, they might have a lot of power, but they're also arguing and fighting with each other and competing. So, many years ago, Lumpur Sumedho said that a good way of understanding the Asura realm is to look at the realm of politics. And so, yeah, the people are powerful, they're intelligent, they've got a lot of resources, but the attention goes on to jealously competing for power and position and influence and so on and so forth. And in the suttas, there's often the asuras try to start a fight with the devas. They're jealous of them because they have such, you know, luxury and comfort. So the asuras will start a fight and try and take over the devas' territory and subdue them, and so that you get accounts of wars between the devas and the asuras happening from time to time. Vipachiti was one of the leaders of the asuras and the leader of the. It's usually against the devas of the Tavatimsa heaven. So Saka or Indra is the one who's usually leading the kind of deva army to counter the attack of the asuras. So it's a bit like the sort of the Greek or the Norse gods, the kind of different factions fighting with each other, and vying for supremacy, and so that there's a, you come across that as part of the scriptural form. The animal realm represents the states of mind dominated by food, sex, territory, and animal instincts. Often we like to think of ourselves as living a very refined life, but I would suggest that a lot of human life revolves around the animal instincts. Can I eat it? Is it going to eat me? Can I mate with it? Does it want to mate with me? Does it want to come into my territory? Can I get into its territory? If you look through the news, a lot of it is about the animal realm. I realize also it's a somewhat sweeping statement, but even though we as human beings, we think that we're way above the animal realm and think that we're far more sophisticated and refined and intelligent and far beyond those animal drives. But if we look, say, rather than living in the manusaloka, you know, a lot of our life revolves around the asura realm and the animal realm, and driven by those kind of instincts and habits, and we can dress it up in various different ways and give it a different coating, but a lot of what motivates people in the world and their lives revolve around sort of basic animal instincts. So that might sound a bit offensive or a bit overcritical, but I think if we look around, we don't have to look very far to see, especially if you notice how, not that I'm keeping watch on anybody, but when it's breakfast time and you haven't eaten since the midday of the day before, if you notice that servery gets very, very interesting, and you stop noticing the other people around and the attention. Again, I'm not spying on anyone, but it is interesting how the attention goes very firmly to what's on the servery and what people, insofar as they might be in the way. So right there, that's I would say is the animal realm of like the search for there's hunger, there's a search for food. Food becomes of intrinsic value, and the attention goes firmly towards it. Again, I wouldn't presume to know exactly what's going through everybody's mind, but that's easily the case from my own experience. So then the hungry ghost realm is the arena of all-consuming addictions, hungers that cannot be satiated by consumption. Addiction to alcohol or to nicotine or to addictive drugs are clearly visible realms of endless hunger. This is the mind absorbed into the destructive cycle of consuming a desired substance and being unable to escape from that. The hungry ghost, or peta in Pali or preta in Sanskrit, has a very small mouth but is always hungry. So in the imagery of the hungry ghost realm, the hungry ghosts have a large or swollen stomach and a tiny, tiny mouth, sort of small as a needle. So even though they're always hungry, they can't get very much food into their mouths, so that hunger can't be satiated. No matter how much the body or mind consumes of its drug of choice, it never gets enough and is always hungering for more. That's the hungry ghost realm. There can be other kinds of addiction, more refined than drugs and alcohol, which will be explored in due course. So again, this is a way that Lumpur Samhita would describe that, the hungry ghost realm, the realm of addiction. So that the mind is focused on that one thing that it's got to have. And so things like alcohol or nicotine or heroin or cocaine or whatever, those kind of very obvious drugs where when we use the word an addict or addicted to those substances, and then people have to work really hard to get free of those addictions if they're lost in them. So that's a tangible experience of the hungry ghost realm, ever hungry and never quite able to satiate that. It can be alleviated a little bit from time to time, but it is being born into that realm is that the mind is just focused on that one thing that's going to scratch that particular itch. The hell realm comes last. This is all about pain and heat and conflict. This describes the mind in the state of anger, oppression, and hatred. There's an intense focus on pain and the aversion that arises as a consequence of that. When we're angry with someone and are absorbed in that conflict to the point where we want to destroy something or someone, this is the experience of the hell realm. In the hell realm, it becomes more important to escape from pain or to destroy or to harm or to hurt anything else in the world. So the mind gets, again, shrinks to that painful state and then gets lost in aversion and the kind of the heat of contention against another person, or just that the mind is in a state of burning destructiveness and just wants to get rid of the object of aversion or destroy it or cause it pain. The 12 links of dependent origination around the rim of that picture with Mahakala, they depict the pattern by which the wheel turns, and that completes the picture, the mirror into which we are looking. Again, it might all sound very complicated, but this is a visual way of conveying the teachings on how we create trouble for ourselves and how the heart can be freed from that trouble. We free ourselves by understanding the mechanism of how that trouble gets created. Understanding, and not just conceptual understanding, but the direct and complete insight, that the sort of non-conceptual direct insight understanding. Understanding the mechanism of how that trouble gets created. Understanding enables us to no longer create it. And in the picture of the wheel, maybe Lindsay can pass that around if people are interested. The 12 images, it might be a little bit difficult to see what they're representing, but it's interesting that regardless of the country that this image appears in, whether it's in Thailand or India, Nepal, Sri Lanka, Burma, China, Japan, Korea, and all around, Tibet, they use pretty much the same images to represent the 12 links. So the first one is a blind person representing avijja, and not being able to see. And also ignorance, just to mention the word ignorance, in ordinary English usage, to be ignorant means you haven't got certain information or you don't know how to perform a particular task. So, but the Pali use of the word avijja, it's a bit more, it's not just not having information, but it's probably best translated as unawareness or unmindfulness, not seeing clearly. So the image of a blind person where the visual realm is shut down is a good representation of that. So it's the word ignorance has been used for so long, it's almost, you know, that sort of a fixed way of translating avijja. But it's essentially it's not knowing. Vijja is to know or to be aware. Avijja is to not know, to not be aware. So it's an unmindfulness, a distractedness, an unawareness. So then avijja paccaya sankhara. Sankhara, sankhara literally means to form or to make, and that's the image of a potter making a clay pot. Sankhara paccaya vijnana. So the vijnana is represented in this particular wheel by a monkey in a tree reaching for a fruit. So there's that knowing that object and reaching taking hold of that object. Then namarupa is represented by it's actually a few people. It's just one person in a little rowing boat. So the mind and the body represented by the little boat, by the dinghy, and then a person sitting in the boat representing the nama or the mind. This one has got three or four people in the boat, so I'm not quite sure the background to that. Maybe multiple personality, a few people different members of the committee riding in the boat together. But the nama rupa, nama being the mind or mentality, rupa, materiality, or the body, material form, represented by the boat. Then the next one is a house with six windows. Sometimes it's a house with five windows and a door. But that represents the six senses, the six sense doors, the salayatana, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And then contact, pasa, so when with the six senses, there's the sense organ, so the eye, and then visual form, rupa, and then when the visual form is received by the eye, and then our eye consciousness arises. So, and the coming together of those three, the eye, the sense organ, the object, and the consciousness arising through the reception of the object, that is called pasa, or contact. So in this imagery, you have a couple embracing, so that represents contact, pasa. Then feeling, pasa pachaya vedana, so contact conditions feeling, is somebody with an arrow in their eye. So definitely using painful feeling as a way of representing feeling. So that's the impact of vedana, feeling. And then feeling conditions craving. And so that's, again, you have a couple holding hands. Tanha. Well, I think it may be somebody giving somebody a dish of food. It's a bit hard to see the two people close to each other, either holding hands or somebody giving them something to eat. And then the next one, upadana, clinging or grasping. So this is the image of somebody. They've already got a basket that's filled to the brim with fruit, and they're reaching up into a fruit tree to pick even more. So it's like their basket is already full, but they're grasping for more. So that's upadana. And then bhava, becoming. There's a couple in bed together, representing, you know, that becoming, or that being, you know, lost in that, say, the particular feeling of the coming together. And then jati, birth, is a woman lying down with a baby next to her. It has just given birth, jati. And then the last one on the list is jara marana, aging and death. So you have somebody with a large backpack, they're striding along, and then a funeral pyre at the very end. So that's the visual imagery depicting dependent origination. And again, you know, that it probably was the case that this was used from the earliest times, so most of the people who were listening to Dhamma talks were illiterate, they couldn't read. And so just as you have in Christian churches all over Europe, they have stained glass windows and murals that depict certain stories and will be themes for religious instruction in the church, you know, that you can tell a story with pictures for people who can't read. Up until very, very recently, the vast majority of people in Buddhist countries would have been illiterate or semi-literate, and so having pictures and indicate these particular qualities as a very handy way of describing what's going on. So, any questions?
Thoughts? Yes. Is one supposed to see the 12 links of dependent origination in any Magga, Pala, Nibbana enlightenment moment, or just before it? I think I heard somewhere that you might not actually understand what they are. I think it may be Bhikkhu Bodhi giving his lectures on the Abhidhamma.
Yeah. I think the statement I was quoting the other day, that one who sees the dependent origination sees the Dhamma, one who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. I wouldn't say that necessarily has to be every nuance of each of the 12 links, but I would say seeing dependent origination is that attuning of the heart, the jitta, to how the whole thing is working. So like Lumpur Cha's image of falling out of a tree, you're trying to count the branches that you're going past on the way down. Like there's a lot of detail there. But so that I would say that it's that sense of attunement of how it works is, and an appreciation of the validity of that sense of this is how this whole system operates. It's like this. Like once you you've seen a puzzle, or if you're doing a crossword, you know, oh, that's what the word is that fits in there. Like, oh, that's the solution to the puzzle. Aha, that's how it works. So it's that kind of aha, that resolution and seeing that beyond a doubt in a non-conceptual and direct way that this is what's going on. And it's also, to me, it's interesting, like I was reading that passage about just after the Buddha's enlightenment, you know, after spending a week absorbed in meditation under the Bodhi tree, then he spends all this time, hours, of going through the contemplating for hours and hours the paticcasamuppada part of the arising part, the cessation part, and the arising and cessation. So going back and forth and looking at the different parts of it as a process over many, many hours after his enlightenment to explore how it's all the details and nuances of how it's working. So I can't say what's in the Abhidhamma. It's not something I've studied to any degree at all. But I would, my immediate feelings, that's what is that sense of seeing the realization of path and fruit. It's not like all the detail of that picture. It's just the sense of aha, this is how it fits. Sister Tanavijaya.
I have a question about asuras. I wonder if it just never made sense to me, their position in the heavenly realm. And I wonder if it's to be taken with a pinch of salt. You liken them to the Nordic gods and Greek gods, and they would be probably from the same era and probably from the understanding of common folks of if you are rich and powerful, you can do whatever you want,
mm-hmm.
and you literally decide the fate of people. But in terms of Buddhist teachings, they're supposed to represent some sort of lofty, refined state of mind, and how being jealous and fighting has to do anything with heavenly realm or higher state of consciousness or. How do you get to be jealous and be a god?
Well, if you're the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, you've got a degree in classics from Oxford University. Yeah. So, I mean, just to use a random example, I'm not entirely joking. It's like, you know, that because deva doesn't necessarily mean particularly wholesome. It means that they've got a lot of privilege. You can, like Venerable Ananda Maitreya saying, the devas. These devas, they're utterly foolish. He said, most devas are not the slightest bit interested in Dhamma. They're just sort of, you know, lost in their own, you know, happy experiences, partying.
So in terms of rebirth, like literal rebirth, you can be prone to jealousy and power and still be reborn as a god.
In Buddhist cosmology, the human realm is seen as the most beneficial realm to be born in. Buddhas are always born in the human realm because it's the most fertile ground for developing insight. Because you have, as Lumpur Sumedha would put it, you have the body of an animal but the mind of a god, and so that the beings who are born in the deva realms. That they have so much, pleasure or power, so much intelligence, they can get completely lost and not be using their blessings. And so, it's often, if you read a lot of Buddhist cosmology, mythology, which I have done quite a bit over the years, then it's often the case that devas are represented as sort of wasting their substance. That it's like being born in a privileged family, having piles of money when you're growing up, and just growing up to be a really obnoxious person. You know, that you've been used to having lots of money and social position and taking all that for granted. But you've inherited that. You're born into that, but you're not making very good use of it. And so that. It's seen as much more advantageous to be born in the manusaloka, in the human realm, because there's a mixture of pleasure and pain. There's the possibilities of degrees of sort of deva-like happiness and pleasure, particularly with meditation, but there's also the limitations of the body and the dukkha of having to eat and having to deal with the weather physical sicknesses and so on. So that oftentimes people like Lumpu Cha or Lumpu Buddhadasa, when people say they want to be reborn in the heavenly realms, they say that's a really stupid idea. Yeah, you just get lost in that. Well, like Anya, her daughter's funeral, Jasmine, I mean, her 27-year-old daughter who died very tragically. At Jasmine's funeral, her mother said, I really hope you've gone to a good place, but please don't have too much fun with the devas because, you shouldn't forget the Dhamma while you're up there. It was kind of a wonderful, wise advice from the mother. At her daughter's funeral, she was obviously very tragic and painful. But I thought all credit to her at her daughter's funeral to say, I really hope you're in a nice place, but don't get lost, Don't get carried away with with playing with the devas. Don't forget the Dhamma teachings. That's what's going to really benefit you. So that the human realm is Buddhas always appear born. The last life of a bodhisattva is always in the human realm, according to Buddhist mythology. And so that it's because it's seen as like the most potent and fertile ground for the development of insight and liberation. Yes.
When the use of the term realm makes me think that these are different time-space continuums, but as the conversation is going on now, it sounds like they share the same time-space continuum. What is a realm? How is that different?
I think it depends who you talk to. But you can think of it as parallel universes or different dimensions. Like right now, are you aware of radio waves? We're not. But if we had a radio and turned it on, then we'd be able to hear BBC or whatever. And so, but they're passing through this hall, the radio waves or TV broadcasts or whatever, they're passing through, but we don't see them. They're present, but we don't have the piece of kit that enables us to tune into them. So I've always been totally comfortable with the idea of different realms of existence. It's always, ever since I was a small child, that made perfect sense to me. And I'm always slightly surprised when other people just say, "Whoa, rubbish, nonsense," And it's still, even after all these years, I'm still slightly taken aback when people say that has no credibility. I've never had an experience of visiting any other realms or meeting any other beings that are visibly or from different realms of existence. But the idea of it has always seemed perfectly sensible to me. And so I would say it's like the parallel universes. And also the experience of one of the interesting things, if you look at the cosmology, is that the experience of time is very, very different. Like we're talking about Brahma gods, like having a breathless conversation and, 5 million years, 5 million human years pass by in a breathlessly rushed conversation. So that the spans of time and the lifespans of beings in those different realms are extraordinarily different and very, very, very long. And so that also makes sense to me that's part of the chemistry, and the more refined the realms are, the more subtle they are, and then the longer the lifespans, or the more sort of glorious. So like in the Arupa, the formless Brahma realms, then the lifespans are like thousands of kalpas long, 20,000, 84,000 kalpas long for a lifespan.
I had an exchange of emails with Ajahn Pumidama, and he called the Preta realm basically an aborted birth, he said, and that's sort of the term he used. It's an aborted birth, and I took on experience I had with ghosts and asked him, how do you think Buddhism would explain ghosts in general? And he basically said, well, the Pretas, because the hungry ghost realm is actually very close to the human realm and is interacting with it, and often they want to get back to where they were before, or come into this realm, find ways into this realm. So there's this interaction between the two. He also said something about you shouldn't wish them well too much, because this is something that they can like and they can keep them in the realm. So it's rather interesting.
There's all sorts of different ways of relating to these principles and different understandings around that. But personally, I feel more loving kindness is usually better. I know in some traditions they say, you know, you shouldn't spread loving kindness to people who've died. But it's like, yeah, but if they're alive in another realm, they're still alive, but they're still in a different realm. So I generally advert to the idea more loving kindness is better. One of the few times more is better. And that I don't quite go along with that.
Yeah, I'm not sure entirely what he meant, really, but I can't remember the context exactly. There was something about if you wish praetors, in particular praetors, give them loving kindness or something about it that actually might be detrimental to their situation, but I can't remember the context exactly.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised at that. One of the things, again, that Venerable Ananda Maitreya, who talked about this kind of dimension quite a bit, he said that sharing merit is very, very helpful for beings in different realms, and that as human beings, to consciously offer up the goodness of your life to deliberately share that and they offer that for well-being of others. He made a point saying that's something that brings great blessings. And I think he was not just speaking from a knowledge of the Pali scriptures, but he's also his own experience, his own insight into that dimension. That it's said that for beings in certain realms, that's the food they live on, is the good wishes and blessings, the good karma from people. And one of the stories that you come across is Venerable Mahamoggallana. His mother was had lived quite unskillfully, and she had died and had been reborn in a hell realm, and he went down to visit her I'm not sure of the exact story, but I think he was consciously sharing the merit of his life with her, so that she could end her life and her life could come to an end in the hell realm, and she could get reborn in a different location. Yes.
I'm wondering, I was trying to think about the different gradients, the realms, and what was kind of distinguishing each of them. And so initially I thought maybe it's virtue, but it didn't, like, at the time the Jarasana felt like maybe in one of those realms, actually virtue really isn't apparent for the devas. And so I'm wondering, is it craving that really distinguishes those different levels of the realm? Because the devas, although they're not perhaps more virtuous, because they've got quite a lot of ready, they're perhaps not craving as much, and so perhaps that's why they're in a higher realm. So I'm wondering, is there anything to that? I'm wondering, what is it that distinguishes each of the realms?
It's a good question. The essentially, it's karma and its results, the actions that you follow. So if you've lived very skillful, and this is something that is sort of quite a large part of common understanding in many Buddhist countries. So if you lived a skillful life in the past, then that creates wholesome karma. So it might mean that you're born in a fortunate family in the human world, or you're born in the Deva realm. But then what you do, having been born in that realm, what you do with that is up to you. Like if you might be born into a rich family or a privileged family, but then live a totally wasteful life or get really confused and self-destructive. And so, yes, you were born into a pleasant and beneficial situation, but the choices that were made or the way that turned out didn't lead to liberation. And so that it's kind of like snakes and ladders. I mean, snakes and ladders, I think, is a very ancient Indian game, and I think it's really based on the laws of karma and vipaka. That, like, you can be born as a Brahma god, and you can your next life can be back in Hemel Hempstead. there's one particular Brahma realm I'm very fond of, which is called the Asanyasata Brahma realm, and it's one of the very high Brahma realms, and so. In the description of it, asanya means unconscious. So you create a lot of good karma. It's based on having very, very purified, refined mind states from meditation. But in that particular realm, you're unconscious the whole time. So it's described, you have this sort of, you're born into this glorious landscape, you have this kind of fantastically radiant Brahma body, but for the entire lifespan, you're totally unconscious. And then that life comes to an end, and then you can be reborn anyway, can be back in the human realm or wherever it might be. And so you can be a Brahma god, you can be born as an animal afterwards, you know, if the karma is there in the mixture. And so, and the reason why beings get born as in the Asanya Sata Brahma realm is like, if your meditation is based on aversion to the sense world, if there's a kind of negativity or pushing away of sense and the sense world and thinking, so that yes, there's a lot of concentration, yes, it's very refined, there's a lot of wholesomeness, but that not wanting to feel, not wanting to experience, not wanting to sense, that ripens in the being born in the Asanya Sata Brahma realm. So you're there for like gazillions of years, but you don't enjoy it because you're unconscious the whole time. So, dang.
So it sounds like karma decides what realm you end up in, but the level of realm is the level of suffering and freedom from craving, in a way. Is that correct?
Well, it's the realm that the mind gravitates to is based on the particular nuances and the mixtures of karma, and so that, but there can be various influences there in the mixture, so that that could be, you know, kind of, yes, you're living a comfortable life, and yes, things are very privileged, but actually your bank is about to collapse, and so you're riding on a set of privileges that can disappear very quickly, like snakes and ladders. You know, you can be up in the 99th square, and you know, down the snake you go to back to square number one. And so that there can be a lot of virtue in the mix, but it can be masked by some particular vipaka, some sort of resultant karma. So the stories, like in the scriptures, also in the Jataka stories in particular, there's lots and lots of examples of the sort of mixtures of karma, where a being's born into a particular family or a particular realm, and that they have the influence of previous lifetimes still carry on, and that the essential theme, and really what's the purpose of this book and the teachings, is that what makes the difference is what we do with the present moment experience here and now. And so that nothing is really fixed. There's nothing is it's never too late. there's no karma that has an absolutely just sort of destructive or obstructive result. So that, you know, you can be born in a really unfortunate situation, but if there are skillful choices that are made, then over a number of lifetimes one can rise out of that, or that there can still be resonances of painful, unskillful acts in the past. Like Mahamoggallana, he died by being killed by bandits, because many, many, many lifetimes before, he had he'd killed his parents, and so that little nugget of unfinished business was still there in the mix, even though he was an arahant and the Buddha's second disciple. And in the stories, it goes like he's trying to escape from these bandits, no matter how hard he tries, and all these magical tricks that he does, you know, flying through the air and disappearing through keyholes and making himself invisible. The guys keep, like in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, you know, who are those guys? Whatever we do, we can't get away from them. And then he realizes, he kind of puts his mind on to go, oh, yeah, I'm not going to get away from this. This is the old unfinished business. So eventually he gets killed by the bandits. Similarly, Venerable Sariputta, it said, liked to skip over puddles. in the rainy season. And some of the other monks were upset about this. You know, he's supposed to be your chief disciple. He's behaving in this undignified way. And when there's a puddle on the pathway, he likes to skip over these puddles. You know, this is very improper for a supposedly austere and dignified monk. And the Buddha said, well, in a previous lifetime, he was a monkey. And the monkey liked skipping over puddles. And so this is a resonance of that previous lifetime as a monkey. We could spend a lot of time on these stories. I think
I had a question about your reflection this morning. You were saying how vijnana is where the mind is creating a self, buying into the thoughts of self, and then that leading to nama rupa creates that subject object.
Not quite. If I'm more, I mean, it's complex, but they work together. They lean on each other, vijnana and nama rupa, and you know, and as the reading I gave yesterday, the Buddha says nama rupa conditions vijnana conditions nama rupa. That they're the source and the cause for each other. They lean on each other. They fuel each other, and so that. In that kind of combination, then the vijnana side of it that feeds the sense of a subject, the quality of cognizing or knowing or the subject side of the equation, and then the nama rupa forms the object side, and so that you have ignorance conditions. Formations, conditions, consciousness, conditions, mind and body, or mentality, materiality. So that, again, it's not just sort of 1, 2, 3, 4, but rather, if when the mind doesn't see things clearly, then there's avijja, that conditions sankhara, that sense of this and that, of the whole realm of things in the most germinal basic way, and that sankhara as a seed, if you like, that as a root, that sort of develops strength. It kind of divides into, on the one hand, vijnana being the kind of cognizing subject side, and into the other side, which is the nama rupa, which is the object side of the five khandhas. And so then that is how the source, the subject object, me here, the world out there, forms based on ignorance, not seeing clearly. Then that me here, the world out there, takes shape. So it's just but I would stress it's just one way of talking about it or considering it. It's not like a sort of a categorical, this is the one true interpretation, but that's how I most helpfully understand it. And so that the vijnana part is it sort of strengthens into there's a me here who's seeing and who's thinking and feeling, and there's that, there's those people in the room out there. There are these, you know, words arising in my mind that are coming from, you know, that mind. And so that Bhikkhu Nyanananda called the nama rupa vijnana vortex, that kind of strengthens from that seed of the basic division of sankhara, then strengthens into there's me here and a world out there, the subject object. And then the next one on the list is the six senses. So then that, in the same kind of vein, then, oh, there's the sense world seems very, very solid and is known by this agent, the me who's experiencing the senses. Then that conditions, you know, feeling and contact and feeling, and then into craving. That's all explained later on. Talk about it in more detail. But I hope that gives some kind of a picture. Okay, well, I'm also speaking of pictures. It's now 10 past, so we should wind up this evening.
Sadhu.